You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. My guest today is Caroline Furman. Caroline is a wonderful dancer. I'm so glad she was able to join me for the podcast. We were at Juilliard together where we did work with ArtReach, a student outreach group. She is a fantastic dancer and a dynamic teacher who does amazing work with children and nonprofits. I admire her very much and love having this space and time to talk with her about her life as an artist. I hope you enjoy the 36th episode of The Compass. So what is the dark side for you? And how do you try not to go there as an artist? That's the big first question.
So the dark side, yeah. The dark side for me has been really informed by trying to view it from a 180 degree perspective difference. So trying to see the dark side in a positive light. Because I don't do so well compartmentalizing my experiences as an artist. So I like to be able to use everything I'm going through. So for me, the best metaphor I can use is I've been using the dark side as a metaphor for digging deep, going very dark into soil. Or I've been thinking about the metaphor of compost and how it is decay and it is a mess and it maybe smells bad and it doesn't look pretty, but it is the fruit of that process, and it creates growth. And that has been my experience every time with a dark side. Every time I put off the dark side and say no, I don't want to go there, let me stay bubbly, let me stay light, let me stay productive,
positive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all these industrious words, I find that the dark side trip gets deeper and deeper when it eventually happens, and it will. So this, I just went through a big transition, and during that time, I said, you know what, to hell with it, I'm going in, I'm going to really let myself go dark, and so I let myself go there now, and by that I mean, I let myself be ugly, I let myself be tired, I let myself be burnt out, I let myself be unproductive. Now really dark, where I start to feel dark feelings about myself or about my worthwhileness, worthiness. That's a different type of dark side for me, one that's not useful. So I try to make a delineation between the two, and I find if I indulge the darkness of the slow place, of the messy place, of the lazy sometimes, or jaded, that's been a dark place.
Yeah.
Then that other darkness of you're not worthwhile, that usually doesn't come out.
That's a hard thing about us using our bodies and using ourselves for our art, though, is that sometimes it is easy to I'm not working, or someone doesn't want my work, and so therefore they don't want me or the worthwhileness, if you can keep that separate, that's huge.
I mean, it's not always successful, but I find that as I get older, it's a muscle. It's a muscle that I've flexed and practiced, and to the point of doing really cheesy stuff, writing a post-it on the mirror every time. You are beautiful. Look in the mirror and say you are beautiful. This is so dumb. But it works. I try to stay playful as a way of staying out of some really darkness. So, sometimes it's helpful to journal and to discuss and debate, but often I just walk away having an existential crisis. So I try to go back to play, and I'll do a little internet game with some friends. I'll email them a short dance phrase that I've been working on, and but I'll write it. I won't show it to them. I'll like write it in words, kind of like an exquisite corpse.
Uh-huh.
And then they have to interpret the writing in their own dance. Like,
oh, I love that.
In the back. You know, something silly and fun, or I make a lot of dance videos, quote unquote, where I think things that I think are hilarious, like a funny scenario, and just have someone dancing around and, you know, post that every now and then. Just something to keep it playful.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about the transition that you mentioned?
Yeah. So, as a dancer, your limit for a certain type of work comes with age, and with age on the body. And so maybe it's not necessarily, you know, your age per se, but the age on your body. And
right.
The work that I was doing my whole life was very rigorous. So classical ballet and mm-hmm. hardcore modern, and then getting into some contemporary work, some Israeli style movement. And then the work that we were making with the company I was with, Galim Dance, was very aggressive, very athletic.
Mm.
Big jump, land in a squat. Big jump, land in a squat. Run, hit someone, like hit a wall, like run into a brick wall and fall down. I'm like, let's explore that for a week, you know? Oh my God. I remember this one thing I had to do was other people would jump straight up in the air and grab the bottoms of their feet. And I would have to try to roll under their feet before they landed again.
Oh my, how many times did you get stomped on?
Zero times.
Yes.
Because
good job.
I rehearsed. But you know, I left that rehearsal like with, you know, a year shaved off of my life.
Oh my gosh.
You know? So, and then on top of that, the touring, mm-hmm. which I'm really glad I did. That was a dream of mine as a kid, to travel the world and dance. And I did.
That's amazing.
But it takes a toll. And so around the time I turned 28, I started to feel my knees sounded like cellophane. And I was super tired and just feeling thin, literally and metaphorically. And it got to the point where I actually had a heart murmur.
Oh my goodness.
And I was so, so tired. My body was just like, you need to stop. And I knew deep down, like, that I could have pushed on, but I also knew I was just tired, and also tired of the lifestyle. That's, you know, it's a lifestyle for a young person to run around, to get paid very little, no PT, no massage, you know, you do it yourself. It's a labor of love, but it's not sustainable, and that's a huge problem, actually, in the dance world right now. So,
do you feel like... I want to keep talking yeah. about this transition, but do you feel like you were aware of this? I'm just curious for dancers, like, is that something that was talked about at school or from older dancers? Like, was that something that you felt mentally prepared for having to deal with someday, or was it, did it come as a surprise?
A little of both. I think we were prepared as much as we could at school. We had information about this place called Career Transitions for Dancers, which is really useful, and, you know, counseling and stuff like that. But I think it was a shock to me in terms of how quickly it came.
Mm-hmm.
It came a little sooner than I thought for myself, because I'm known for stamina and consistency, so I was amazed that it happened that quickly.
Right.
And I wasn't prepared for the lifestyle problem. You know, I don't think my teachers knew. They didn't grow up in this time that we grow up in as artists right now, where everyone is hustling.
Yeah.
Like, they were like, you're going to join a company. Good work.
And now it's much more, everyone's freelance, even if you're with a company, it's sometimes, right?
Yeah. I mean, even if you're with a very established company, you know, I was just talking to actually someone who was my Uber driver,
uh-huh.
and he started chatting, and thought, wow, he's really knowledgeable about the arts. And he was like, oh yeah, I sing for the Metropolitan Opera, like core, mm. and when we're off, I drive Ubers. Like, yep, sounds relatable.
Yeah.
So I don't think I was prepared for that, and I don't think my friends were either. I've got friends that were in very high-level, prestigious companies in Europe and the United States who are 30 and done. They move back home to, you know, Nebraska or wherever, and are just sitting at their parents' house, like, zoned out. Because we're tired. That was too much. That was a lot of work.
Yeah.
A lot of work. So
you packed it into those years.
Yeah.
So intensely.
And you're an athlete. You know, there was, mm-hmm. when I was younger, I was like, dancers aren't athletes, they're artists.
Right.
But as I get older, I'm like, no, that's athletic. Like, we're definitely athletes. And you look at any athlete and they have a shelf life physically. Now, that being said, I think that there's a lot of things older dancers can offer, and I've seen it. But it's hard to find people that want to see that in the United States, or that want to choreograph for that, or that will pay money to see that. And I think it's similar in many art forms, but dance especially, you know. And a lot of it comes from, if you're not willing to dance this many hours for this much money, we'll find someone that is, and they're usually much younger and willing. So I made the choice around like 28, 29 to start transitioning out for physical and mental reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not pretty. That was rough.
Yeah.
Really sad. Really sad. And still is sad, but I am more at peace with it.
So you've been doing a lot of teaching, you said?
Yeah, I've always been a teacher. Always had a second passion, which I think is really lucky.
Yeah.
I know that's not true for everyone. That being said, it doesn't fill the same space as dance, and I'm learning that. But yeah, I've been teaching a lot, too much, actually. It's really nice. With all my experience, I get a lot of great jobs, so that's positive. But I haven't performed in over a year and a half. I haven't choreographed. I haven't seen a dance show because I work nights,
right,
teaching after school. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Empty, like empty.
You need something to fill, like refill your well.
Yeah. Creative well. And so back to like this idea of like little games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I maybe can't put on like a magnum opus, but I can do small things to stay creative.
Are you teaching all like dance classes, or are you using dance to teach other things?
Question.
I'm so curious.
It's my favorite question. It's, I teach straight up dance, and in those regards, I like to teach, you know, in those types of classes, I like to teach much higher level kids. With teaching dance to teach other stuff, that comes through nonprofit organizations such as A-Step, where we work with kids and or you know, young adults, teaching them leadership skills or self-confidence through the arts. One of my favorite things that I do right now is work with a company called Dance Wave, which is a nonprofit for kids down in Brooklyn. And starting I kind of made my own job there. I said, I really would like to work for you. I think this is how many hours a week I would work. This is what I would do. I was really scared the first time I ever did that. Like, I'll just be a consultant, your education consultant. And
are they are able to pay you as a teaching artist?
Yeah. I'm more consultant there. It's really interesting. Okay. I really made my own role there. She said, you know, what would you want to do here? And I said, let me think about it. I'll think about it for a couple of weeks. And I wrote a proposal.
That's awesome.
It was very nice. And so for them, I'm kind of helping create an assessment program. So the company uses the tools that I'm creating, and it's still a work in process, to work with the kids on things that are outside of the art form. So how you participate in a group. Are you professional? Do you come on time? Are you respectful? Do you have any critical thinking skills? Do you how honest are you in your assessment of yourself? All skills that are useful if you want to be a doctor, if you want to be a dancer, like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And then I'm developing a rubric and an assessment so that we can kind of track the kids' progress. And through that rubric, we are securing different types of grants for leadership training and stuff. So it's a really satisfying
job. It's really exciting.
Yeah, really satisfying job. But it's part time.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about how you piece together the financial stuff these days?
Yeah. Finance is something that I think more artists should talk openly about.
Yeah.
With, like, real numbers. I was always the one to negotiate our contract in the company and look up legal help and research other companies and compile information. So, you know, if anyone asks, you know, what my salary is, how much I think people should be charging, I will give real numbers. I think that's a source of power for artists. And actually, did you know it's illegal to have a contract that bars you from talking about your salary?
Oh.
That's a federal.
I feel like it's just like an unspoken thing that you're not supposed to ask. But that's good to know that it's not a legal thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, it's not legally binding federally. Mm.
Dun, dun, dun. That's awesome that you took that initiative on yourself.
Yeah.
To learn about it. And now that you're, like, freelancing and doing your own thing, I'm sure it comes in handy.
So, yeah. So I've been able to kind of look at my expenses, see how much I would need to make. So I've come up with myself a weekly rate, mm-hmm. a monthly rate, a day rate, an hourly rate for myself. And that's kind of what I've settled on, and that's what I give out to everyone, depending on, you know, what kind of project. I'll say, this is what you could pay me hourly, this is what you could pay me daily, weekly, or we can talk salary.
Do you feel like you ever get pressure from them to be like, no, we're the ones who
Absolutely.
Say, this is what we pay you hourly?
Well, I've become like a businesswoman.
That's amazing.
I like actually quit dancing for a company and was like, I'm going into the freelance jungle. And I bought myself, like, a blazer and heels. I was like, I'm doing this.
You had the makeover montage.
Yeah, totally. Like, and now your outside matches your inside. But I thought, you know, if you're going to change the way that this is going, and I feel very strongly, like, I will get very heated about this. I feel very strongly that my career be treated like a legitimate career. And so mm-hmm. you have a lot of people, oh, how about this one, your favorite? You should be so lucky that you're doing what you love. Or like, what about for me? Let's do $50. You're like, would you ever do that with your hairdresser? Like, this is a great hairstyle, but can I just pay you, you know, half of what I paid you last time?
And I'll buy you pizza.
Yeah, and I'll buy you pizza. That never happens. And I think it delegitimizes this as a career choice, as a legitimate career choice. And I spend a lot of time in Europe traveling too, and a lot of dancers go to Europe, and that's so legitimate. Like, you can work there as a dancer, it's respected.
And they have a structure for it.
They have a structure, and so that's kind of influenced me. The other thing is dancers don't have a union.
Mm.
So I've learned a lot from my actor friends, and that has influenced the way I talk to people who try to barter me low. And so I will do the traditional tactics. I will come in high. Like maybe 6 times out of 10, I'll get the high ball offer. That's a good lesson. I think artists undervalue their work.
Yeah.
So I'll go in armed with why I'm the right person for this job, and I'll get the salary that I was asking. And if I won't, the negotiated price is always acceptable. And there have been 3 or 4 times where I've not budged and said, like, I really can't do it for less than that. And I lost the job, you know? And I think that's okay. This is part of building standards, and that's that flexing that muscle.
Yeah. And then you had those hours in your month to find something that would pay your bills.
They always fill in. Even if it's with babysitting, you know?
Yeah.
I think the other side to that coin is holding myself to this high esteem, which sometimes feels cocky and presumptuous. And I think, you know, as a humanitarian, I don't want to imagine that I'm better than anyone. But you kind of have to. It's just like an audition when you're negotiating money or hours. You know, sometimes it's not negotiating money, it's negotiating the time. Okay, well, if that's all you can pay, then this is as much as I can work. I'm not going to kill myself for that. But the flip side of that is staying humble and saying, okay, I don't have any work right now. I'll definitely babysit. I'm babysitting on Thursday. I just finished a really lucrative gig in a public school, and then this Thursday I'll babysit all day.
Yeah.
Or I've mascotted, like put on a mascot, like tap mm-hmm. dance on the sidewalk, you know, I'm like, making that money.
I've done it all.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, you got to fill in the gaps. You fill in the gaps somehow.
Yeah. And I think that's just hard work, and I'm not afraid of that.
And do you apply those same standards if a friend comes to you asking if you can collaborate on something or wanting, do you kind of take that as like, okay, I do have the extra energy that I want to make this piece with them mm-hmm. and kind of, they're not paying any, they can't pay anybody. They're in the same situation I am.
Definitely.
Or do you have to kind of not let that take up your time? Cause I know what, like when I came right out of school, I was feeling a little high and mighty a little bit being like, I can't do anything that doesn't pay, you know? But eventually when I let that go, not for people who had the ability to pay me and just weren't, but to collaborate with my peers more, it gave me a lot of the creative outlet that I needed when I wasn't getting the paid work.
That is, I volunteer still, you know, I volunteer, and I work with my friends, and that's different. And there are some friends that, you know, you have to set limits with, and that doesn't mean that we're not friends. That means, like, I can't work 24 hours on this project with you. I love you, but save it for Saturdays. Or, you know, the volunteering. I really believe in this. I don't mind. I know I'm losing sleep. I know I'm losing money doing this, but it's worth it. So I think it's a lot of work. I really liken it to setting up your own business. What are your standards? What is your mission? What is your demographic? What are you, you know, if I'm all about kids, then if someone presents me with this really great opportunity to help kids and they're a proven, you know, company or a proven friend or a proven coworker that will do that, I'll take a pay cut, quote unquote, or I will put in extra overtime for you. And I think talking about it in those terms that already exist are really useful.
Yeah, even just thinking about the word overtime.
Right?
Because so many of us are working like two full-time jobs, basically.
Yeah.
To
just thinking,
have an artistic life.
Yeah, I live in Inwood, which is way in the south of Manhattan. And this dance wave thing that I really love is in Brooklyn. It takes over an hour and a half often to get there. And I'm often complaining, like, oh my God, I don't want to go down there. And I go and I'm like totally fulfilled. And so I just said, you know, I can't really look at this like a job. I have to look at this as part volunteer work, or as something that I'm consciously have control over, that I'm consciously saying yes to. And that takes off a lot of the stress. There are other situations where I say, I'm consciously saying no to this. That is not worth it.
Right.
And it's kind of just deciding your value. What you want to value, and also how much your value is, and I've just been really looking at everything in terms of cost. You know, that's going to cost four nights of sleepless, you know, staying up till midnight on the computer. Is that worth it? Or, you know, it might not be a cost in money. It might be that's going to cost this friendship a lot of stress. Can we handle it right now? Can we afford? Literally, can we afford that? And a lot of this comes from this restorative justice, restorative discipline work that I actually do with kids. So,
tell me about that.
Yeah, the more I work with kids, the more I work with myself better. We're all just kids anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I've been teaching this stuff about social capital, right? So you and I sitting here having this conversation, we're building social capital, which means if you ask me for a favor in a few weeks, I'll be more likely to say yes or vice versa because we put money, social money, into a pot, for instance. And that's just the way humans work. If you keep drawing from this social capital by, let's say you have a company and you're like, sorry guys, we have to stay late again. Sorry, your paychecks aren't coming till next week. Sorry, that $50 we promised you, we can't do it. You're depleting this bank. You're depleting people's goodwill, their social capital. You can put it back in different ways. You don't have to just give people money. You can say, look, but I brought you coffees. You know?
Uh-huh.
And everyone's like, oh, yeah. Or we're having a pizza night on Friday on me, and it what, cost you $40. Or
right.
I spent the time writing you a note, a handwritten note, and I sent it in the mail, and I put a stamp on it. You know, social capital explosion. So it's really, it's not cost only in terms of money. There's this social cost, a social capital cost. And when I view my resources as a bank like that, it makes decisions really easy, really easy. It's like, that's a great opportunity, but it would take too much from the bank. No.
How do the kids receive that? That's so important.
Kids,
that's so important.
You don't actually, I don't actually teach it like that to younger kids, but the way it works with kids is you make circles. It has nothing to do with class. You go around and you say, what are you doing this summer? And everyone gets a chance to say, and great, let's warm up, let's start class. We just spent 5 minutes, but we built social capital. So when it happens really lovely, like let's say, you know, by February, where your eyes are falling out of your head and New York City is like eating you alive with cold weather, I walk into my class and the kids say, you look really tired, are you okay? And I say, actually, no, I'm really not feeling good today. And they make my day so easy.
Aww.
Because we've built this social capital that we can draw from. Now, if I did that every day, I would deplete the bank and they would
right.
start to resent me. But as long as I keep putting in and they keep putting in, you know, it's a really interesting way of weighing things quickly.
Well, and nowadays with all so much technology and everything, I feel like people can be very self-centered and not really aware or empathetic to other people. So that's so important for kids to be, even if they're not aware of it, learning.
Yeah. And I think it's something I try to do with my employers and my employees and my coworkers is build, take the time. It takes more energy
yeah.
than the outset. It does.
Well, we all have those people in our lives who I'm thinking of it now, like who only take
yeah.
and it's tiring.
Yeah,
there's been a few times where I've like connected with someone I hadn't seen, you know, someone was in town or whatever, and you know, the whole hour-long coffee date or something goes by and they don't ask you what, like you realize at the end that they didn't ask you one question about yourself. Not that you want to talk all about yourself, but it was like was only about them, and you're like, oh well, maybe next time they come in town I don't need to carve out a time to see them, because you don't feel
yeah.
like it was a mutual thing at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's that, like, kind of, that's the gift giving of art. And I do think if you, there's a, it's so ephemeral, isn't it? And I think people can take advantage of it. And that's where artists get used, is that we want to give,
yeah,
we want to give gifts of either our art or of our time or of our passion, and it's hard to turn it into a commodity without losing the gift-giving side of it. And so I think you're right. It's just constantly assessing, you know, will I let go some of my standards to do this job, or will I hold on to them? And I think it's a case-by-case thing, and you have to spend the time doing your work to figure out your choice.
How are you feeling about New York City these days? Are you here for the long haul?
I think I'm here for the long haul.
Where's your family at?
I'm from New Orleans.
That's right. That's right.
And then after Hurricane Katrina, they all moved. And I'll say, like, my first year in New York was terrible. It's such a different culture. Completely
yeah.
different culture.
New Orleans has it's such a unique, like, its own culture.
Yes. So slow. If you're not producing something for a while, no one cares. They're like, just have another beer.
Relax.
You know, and that's a wonderful culture, and I go and visit it. It's not the right culture for me to live in, I don't think. I really am enjoying New York. I think I found the right neighborhood for me. I go into the woods and hike a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I can get out of the city easily. I try to get out of the city occasionally, but this is where, especially for dance is so, there's not a lot of places that are happening.
Yeah.
And so this is where I collaborate. New York is a collaboration zone, and that's like my MO. So if I wanted to start my own company, maybe I would go somewhere else. I don't know, though. We just, at the Artist as Citizen conference.
Yeah.
We just spoke to the ex-CEO of PBS, who created a slideshow for us about where all the arts funding lives in the United States. And a huge amount of it is in New York City.
Hmm.
And so, you know, that's another reason. It's, the competition is stiff, but you've got more chances.
The resources.
Of getting resources here, so I think that's also something.
Tell me a little bit about how the conference went. For you guys listening, Alejandro Rodriguez, who's been on the show before, Dylan Moore, a lot of the folks who work with A-Step are involved with this Artist as Citizen conference that did Alejandro spearhead it originally?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And Caroline just participated in it. So how was it?
It's always filling up the hole again, up the emptiness. I always leave having mentored and worked with young artists feeling just as mentored as they were, you know? Like, oh, I learned so much. I just saw one of the fellows on the subway, and she said, you know, I'm getting back into my art. I'm signing up for classes. I started writing again, and she looked all sparkly-eyed, and I returned the gaze with, like, equal sparkly eyes and was like, me too. I started working on a solo, and, you know, we're like, yay, art! So it's just a big pep rally in many ways for those of us involved as on the leadership side and those involved as the fellows.
And the fellows are all, what is it, 18 to 25 kind of age?
Yeah, and they come from all over the world, a very diverse group. It's nice to see them learn from each other, work together. It's a nice microcosm of healthy arts bargaining and negotiating and creating. Everything we just were talking about, you know, they get a nice small way to try that out. And they're prodded and poked and, you know, teased apart and made to think by these different workshops and speakers. And I stayed in the dorms.
That's right, you and Colin.
Oh my gosh.
You're having flashbacks to college.
Yes, I was. Like, oh no, I can't go in here again. But there you go. There's another example of like, okay, I work during the day, and then I'm going to come here around 8 o'clock at night and spend the night, and they want to talk to you. They want to unload. They want to ask your opinion. They're looking for mentors, or they're looking for information. So,
well, and it's a special week for them, so I'm sure they don't care if they stay up to all hours of the night.
So it's, you know, staying up really late, chatting with them. And I knew going in, I said, you know, this is going to cost so much sleep and so much stress, but I'm going to get XYZ out of it, and that is so worth it to me.
Yeah.
It's so worth it. So I just kept kind of that mindset every time I had a 2 a.m. conversation. And I got a lot out of it. I did. You learn a lot from these guys. And you learn we're all the same, asking the same questions, struggling in the same way, and getting excited in the same ways. So it's very family feeling.
Yeah. I think it's so wonderful for them to be exposed to that around like college age, too, because I know a lot of the emphasis is put on competition at that age, either through like watching The Voice or whatever, or like getting into schools, getting the part in the school, getting all this stuff, be exposed earlier to that kind of social justice work and work collaborating that is this exciting thing. It's not just competition. It's a collaboration.
It's
really great.
It's very magical. There's always something magic that happens. And by the end, you're just like, wow, that happened. So everyone has been changed.
The few times I got to come and sit in, it was just so inspiring.
Yeah.
What does your family make of your life as a dancer?
You know, they're very proud, and they say it all the time, and I realize I'm very lucky.
Is anyone else in your family artistically inclined?
No. I'm the Yankee. I don't know. I'm like the liberal Yankee. It's like up here making art. My family all lives in the South. We have very different lives and different perspectives on politics, on religion, on culture. And when I was younger, that sometimes rub me the wrong way, or I would get fiery. As I get older, I realized, why bother? They are so supportive, and they're my family.
Yeah.
And they will, I have an aunt and uncle that send me a little money every month.
That's very sweet.
Very kind. I have my grandma always writing me handwritten notes. Mm-hmm. She's, you know, thinking of me, where am I traveling? If I post something on Facebook, it gets shared 1,000 times. my dad, he's an immigrant. He's a Dominican immigrant. So mm-hmm. He's got the stereotypical, like, hard work ethic. You will succeed, you will do well. Yet, I never got pushed ever by either of my parents to, you know, have a backup plan. They've never asked me, like, what is your backup plan? They're just like, go for it. We trust you. We believe that you'll make it happen. Yeah. And my dad would say, you know, I found these pictures of these dancers in this magazine, and I photocopied and blew them up for you so you can frame them. Like, oh, thank you. Weird
That's
little
so
things
sweet.
Of support, of trying to be connected. You know, that being said, have I felt really estranged or different from them? Yes, many times.
It's hard to communicate what it's the reality of. Yes. It really is, too.
Yes, like when I'm weeping, saying, like, I'm not dancing anymore, and my mom's going, okay, you know, I'm sure you'll do something else again, and you're like, that's not the point. It's like, it's deep. It's
yeah.
Deep. It's like a breakup. It's like a divorce. It's like a death. It's like a big loss, and it's hard to understand that unless you've devoted your whole life to something since you were, I don't know, I was nine. So there, and you know, talking about your art, having someone come see a show, you're like, well, those costumes are real nice. You're like, oh my god, yes.
Did they get a chance to see much of your work after
they
you
did.
Left home?
They did. They'd often be like, cool. You're like, I really want to hear more from you. Like, I want to hear, let's go deep, let's talk about art, you know, and they just either don't want to or don't understand it in that way or didn't like it. I think a lot of times just didn't like what I was doing. That's so hard.
Yeah.
That's so hard when your loved ones don't like your work.
Right, when they can't connect.
Yeah. I legitimately are like, I like what you did before that other dance company or that other show. Or
I try to think of that. This is not the same, but I try to think of that and have empathy when, like, my brother's telling me about this long extended car project.
Totally.
Like something that he's really interested in. I just could care less.
That's the same. Exactly.
But I try to remind myself that everybody has their thing.
That's exactly.
And they might feel the same way about mine.
All involved.
Oh, and our community is all in it and involved. And
so in a way, you know, it's very positive that it's kept me grounded. You know, I remember when I was growing up, you know, teenage years, ballerina, everyone was, you know, not eating well. Everyone around me was calorie counting and, you know, other,
even in New Orleans.
Oh, my gosh. Very, you know, sketchy things in the bathroom, like, not good. And I remember I managed to go through that time relatively unscathed. You know, I had my fair share of weird thinking about, you know, my weight or my body. But a lot of it was my family, and they were just so not involved with that level of art. Or, you know, my dad would be like, well, that's dumb. I'm making, you know, 6 pounds of ribs, and you're going to eat it. Or I remember this clearly. I think it was my dad. He said, if anyone tells you to lose weight, you can have them come to me. and that used to pop into my head in a really positive way. So it's great having a family that aren't involved in that way. They kind of ground you.
What is it like to be dating someone who's not in the arts?
A whole new experience. I've dated only people in the arts. Only people who are very good at what they do in the arts.
Mm-hmm.
Very successful, and so on that we've always been on the same page, and it's been easy to talk to them, and we commiserate and we celebrate together. and I'm now dating someone who has his PhD in psychology. He does research psychology.
Uh-huh.
So he's a research scientist, and he's a teacher. And at first, you know, I thought this is going to be so different, and it turns out it's almost exactly the same. Basically, if you have someone that's really passionate about something, you have someone that's passionate about something. So in that way, it's the same and positive, and we kind of understand each other.
Well, and psychology, too, is closely related to the arts and to storytelling and all of that.
Correct. We can, like, mine the depths of, you know, a thought or a concept for a long time. But in terms of, you know, having this be something that I struggle with to make a living out of, that we're on different pages. And I think it's been an eye-opening and learning experience for him. And it's been validating for me to have someone outside of the circle say, I see you. I see how hard you're working. And I validate that you're really tired right now, or that I understand why you would be frustrated right now. And it kind of feels different coming from a non-artist. We feel like someone from the outside is being like, oh, I see that. I feel you.
Yeah. Well, because for artists, it's always like, well, of course you're still, you have to do more. You have to do more. You have to do more if you're going to make it work.
Or like you're
to an extreme.
Yeah. Or I say, you know, this is my sixth job I've worked this week. And my artist friends are like, this is my tenth.
You know, like, oh. You have no perspective on it.
Yeah, we're all in the same boat. Or that person, you know, gypped me of my paycheck last week. Like, I'm waiting on money from 6 months ago. It's like, oh. Whereas he's like, wow, I don't understand that. I have a salary and benefits, and my job is respected, and I have a union. And he's like, wow, I don't, teach me, like, tell me about what that's like. And it's been therapeutic.
That's really great. Is there anything in, like, the last year or so that you've been really proud of that you want to tell me about? Like, some lesson you learned or something that maybe isn't obvious, but that you are really proud of?
What a great question. And I'm ready to answer it. Because I just did that Artist and Citizen conference, so I was just speaking about this. And it snuck up on me, this realization, that I am so... It's so easy to say I am a dancer. Like, if someone says, you know, what do you do? I say I'm a dancer. I don't say I'm a teacher, choreographer, like, freelance, like, all these slashes, because, you know, I haven't performed in 2 years. I'm still a dancer. And I will say that until I think I probably croak. And that is that's something I'm really proud of. Many, many nights of crying and many dark periods of doubting.
Uh-huh.
That I can say I feel like I own my identity as a dancer, even though I'm not in the height of my physical career. And the way I see myself as a dancer is, I think I've been trained to be an artist. I put in a lot of time. I put in a lot of effort. I see the world in a specific way. I solve problems in a specific way. I digest the world in a specific way. Just me living in the world the way that I do makes me an artist, makes me a dancer. And I really own, like, I really believe that.
Well, that makes me so happy.
Yeah. And I don't have to be on stage, and I don't have to be with the establishment, and I don't have to be, you know, at the big theater, and I can be in my room, and I am a fucking artist. Excuse me.
No, that is fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm very inspired by that.
I'm so
proud of that. Good. I'm so glad you told me about that. Is there any, just to come back to the dark side, like, if you're having a day where you're really going to that place, you're feeling uninspired, are there any, like, concrete things that you turn to again and again, like a book or a place or a thing you do?
Yes. I have a therapy chest. Because, like, I usually have, like, a list of things that I do.
Perfect.
I always go for a hike, like, get into the nature. That's also been scientifically proven to make everyone feel better.
So yeah.
It's just, like, go do that. Sometimes a run, like, exercise. I really, really love the book Women Who Run With the Wolves.
I need to get this book.
By Clarissa Pinkola Estes. It was recommended to me by my good friend Troy Ogilvy and Laura Careless, two lovely dancer women who I went to school with. And she approaches different myths from a female perspective, from a positive feminist perspective. And that's where I get kind of this idea of the dark side being compost instead of death, or that death is a positive thing. It's too much information to go into, but it's basically talking about how everything in life is cyclical, how cyclical nature is often feared because you have to go down into the darkness to come back up. And so I call that my Bible. Like, that book is my Bible. It's all taped up. Its pages are falling out. The stories are in the wrong order.
I get it.
But all I have to do is read two pages, and I'm like, yes. If those things don't work, always a call to a fellow artist friend. You know, always reach out. I feel like there have been times where I've been dangerously low. And, you know, you think, I don't want to bother anyone anymore with this darkness, this sadness. That they've got to be sick of hearing about this. And maybe they are. But if they're your friend, then they're in the community. They get it. And it's always worth reaching out. And so I'll just say, like, I really need to talk to somebody right now. And I've never had anyone turn that down.
And then last but not least, I don't know if you've seen anything recently. I usually ask if you have anything to recommend, or friends shows, or...
How about my second graders performing in the auditorium?
Amazing.
I really haven't...
Or a movie or anything.
Oh, man.
But it's okay if you don't.
What have I been doing? I really haven't seen a lot recently. But something that's really interesting to me is... this pursuit of pleasure in your body, and it comes from this Israeli style of movement, officially called Gaga, is the style.
You know, they did a workshop on that. I went back to Juilliard. They had like a drama alumni day where the teachers taught classes for alums, and somebody came in and did, with a few dance alums were there and the drama alums, and did a Gaga workshop.
Bobby.
She had long hair.
Yeah.
She was very magical.
Yes, she is magical.
It was great.
It's
I loved
amazing.
It.
And actors love it. I've been working a lot with actors in that style of movement. But I recently was speaking to this boy at the Artist's Citizen Conference who lived in Morocco, and another guy who was from Egypt. And they were both like, that sounds really familiar. That sounds like the Sufi style of dance. And I immediately researched it, and we got really excited. We were jiving off of each other, and it turns out a lot of this now codified style, and I don't know if this is where the originator got his information, Oad Naharan, who's this Israeli guy, but it's strikingly similar to this like Sufi trance dancing. And now I'm like super excited, and I want to dig into it, and I recommend to everyone to look into this. It's a really pleasurable way of moving, and that you actually can kind of move through either physical blocks, through, you know, shaking loose your bones and your muscles, or emotional blocks by shaking through or sliding through you know, the parts in your body where you're like no, or the parts in your mind where you're like no. I call it like the three-year-old. It's just like throwing a tantrum. You can kind of move past that with this pleasurable dance.
Yeah.
So that's something that I'm looking into and researching at the moment.
Do you teach any like open classes anywhere that if people wanted to come take your class?
I'm not teaching open classes yet, but that is something I really am trying to
cultivate. Well, if you ever do, tell me and I'll let everyone who listens to the podcast know.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. This was great. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller. Music by Brendan Spieth. Audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.